Welcome to That 80 Show. It feels like a literal week since we were last here. How the hell are you, Dori?
Wait a minute. It's not been a week. Is there some sort of time warp thing that I'm unaware of?
I don't know.
That would be very typically 80s.
Exactly. I got stuck into the Quantum Leap reboot with the time travel. So this is That 80 Show. Let's hear it for the boy. Separating ourselves from Kevin Bacon, you know, I was speaking to a friend this week who runs, he's working on a very cool, smooth streaming radio station in South Africa called Simply Smooth. Dori, have you ever listened to it?
No, I have not.
Our good friend Neil Johnson. Neil Johnson's involved there, right? Yeah.
How do I not know this? I'm going to shout at him for not telling me. How rude.
Oh, no, it's phenomenal. It's a phenomenal, smooth, oldie station. But it wasn't Neil that I was talking to. It was someone else involved there that said that the important thing about that station is you, as cool as it is to have a lot of songs, you kind of want to have songs that people just know the lyrics to. And you kind of want to go through each song and go, I know that and I know the words. I know that and I know the words. I know that and I know the words. And I said, yep. We went through a stage where we were getting like super obscure, playing really weird stuff. Now we rotate through the same 20 songs that everyone knows the words to.
Or do we? Are we mishearing the words?
Oh, no. Listen, so we did a thing. You know, we've kind of been doing misheard lyrics to our opening song, right? And some of them I look at and some are really funny. So far, I've been really funny. The ones on that song just are stupid. Like, if you mishear any of those lyrics and think it's that, like, yeah. I think you've had a head injury. Like, honestly, let's give a dog a bone, even though he smells like pee. Like,
give a dog a bone.
I don't even know where.
Wow. It's like beyond misheard.
No, and that's like not like, you know, gradually losing your hearing over time since the 80s. That's just like you're not a well person in that both you've seen the horrors, but you also don't understand what horrors you're seeing. That's a apt way of describing what's going on. So, Dori, I think last week we reached apex movie recommendation, right?
You think?
Every week on That 80 Show, if it's your first time listening, welcome to the show. We recommend a movie from the 80s for you to watch, a movie or TV show or 80s themed show or something, right? And I found this beauty. And my word, it's such a bad movie, it inspired the Razzies. Right, we missed last week's show. Such a bad movie, it inspired the Razzies. I had to watch it. It's the Village People movie, Can't Stop the Music, which people who heard the show and then kind of started seeking out clips and looking at the stuff we're posting on our Facebook page, That 80 Show, say, we're going, you're right. It's just an excuse to do a song. There's no story, right?
It's a very extended music video.
It is. Did you get a chance to watch the YMCA scene?
I have not. I'll be honest. I have not had a chance to do anything.
Oh.
So it's still on the to-do list.
Well, it's still on our Facebook page. Look, let's just say we find out why it was fun to hang out at the YMCA because there is a lot of functioning equipment, right? All the equipment functioning and glistening, right? So it's fun to stay at the YMCA.
Glistening.
Okay. And then it got me into this like Village People rabbit hole. Now, that's not what happened after each concert that you went, no. They didn't invite you backstage for the Village People rabbit hole. We all know what happened. There was a whole big disco died. There was disco demolition derby where they basically decided a baseball game. We hate disco. It's done. We're destroying everything. And then there was also the song Disco Duck. Have you ever heard that song?
Sounds familiar.
Right.
I had like a Disco Duck record, I think. That sounds really familiar.
Everyone had it. It was super novelty, and it killed disco. Yeah. I don't want to hear demolition. Like,
right.
Disco Duck killed disco. So Village People are going, look, we're like super disco, but like, we're not ready to like hang up our head gear or our headrests or our construction outfits. We've got to keep going.
Our leather caps.
No, yes, exactly. We're still going to get a lot of usage.
Leather headdresses.
None, right? And I started wondering what happened to the Village People post, because they're big in the 70s. What happened to them in the 80s? So I discover a weird little blip, okay, that people seem to have forgotten about. So, Dori, the Village People, to kind of remain relevant, and I see you're about to click on the link.
I am clicking the link.
to remain relevant, they went through a bit of a renaissance. They released an album called Renaissance, right, where they reinvented themselves as a new wave / new romantics band. Okay.
Dude, this picture.
Same members. So now,
wow.
If the village people in your mind are like construction workers, policemen, army guy, whatever, in this little brief period, they cosplayed as Flock of Seagulls, New Order.
Village. Not LA.
So, I mean, and
I can't. Duran Duran. I can't.
Right.
I can't.
The photo you're looking at is in black and white, but their faces are painted white. They're like super, I don't know why their faces are painted white. Like, all the members have super white, doing white face. Like, okay.
Yeah.
And they released this album called Renaissance. I want to play some of the songs. The two hit singles out of this is, he has a song called Do You Want to Spend the Night? Take a listen to this. Like, you can cosplay.
That is still so disco-y, though. Like, come on.
Okay. So that was the one song. The next song is called 5 O'Clock in the Morning, right? They thought this was going to be their big, they're going, you know what, people knew us, we had these cheesy 80s songs, disco stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Cheesy disco stuff. They thought this song is going to make people take us seriously. No more Macho Man, no more In the Navy. We're going to be serious, moody artists, angst. I mean, what's his angst more than wandering the streets alone?
It's so bad. I'm sorry. It's so bad.
So how do you think this album did, Dari?
Not well.
No, not well at all. So they released it. Those two were the singles that they're going to put out. They did not chart at all. Like, you got to understand, right? Charts go up to like 200, right? 200.
Yeah.
Even out of novelty that the village people. Like, I mean, this is just 1979 to 1981. There's still people know them. Just out of pure novelty that the village people have a new song, they've got to be in the 200 best songs released that week. That week. You don't release 200 songs in a week, right?
They couldn't even make it there. Yeah.
Not even.
Oh, no.
Chart.
I'm now seeing the colored photo on the album cover.
It's amazing.
What is with the white face paint? What is going on?
But describe that album cover for us. We'll put all the photos up, but Dori's going to paint a picture for you.
Lots of tight black leather pants and open, what looks like flamenco jackets.
Yeah.
I mean, they look like they're wearing flamenco outfits, as if they're about to go do some ballroom dancing. Well, flamenco dancing. White face paint. Lots of eyeliner. They're like doing that ridiculous pose where they kind of, someone just said something funny and they're laughing.
Yep.
It's so bad. It's so bad.
There is a performance of that 5 O'Clock in the Morning video. They did it on some Top of the Pops or something. They did it on a show. And it is ridiculous. Ridiculous. Of everything I'm going
to
post up.
I'm going to put that up as well.
I'm going to share that.
Yeah.
But Dari, the original village people, do you know they're not all dead?
I'm sure not.
So the guy who was the cop, But they're describing me as cop, admiral, athlete, gigolo, nondescript, right? So, you know, it's, he didn't want any titles.
Okay, which one? Because remember last week we discovered that there was an original cop and then there was a new cop.
Victor Willis, original cop. Then
the one who was married to Felicia Rashad.
Correct. Then the Native American, he's not dead. The GI, he's not dead. Still very much alive. And then we go into, let's look, Leatherman. Still alive. Is he alive? Wait, hold on. No, he passed away 2001. Okay, so Leatherman's dead. Construction worker, still alive, with his huge package. The cowboy is still alive. So actually, only Leatherman, and listen, he has a biker. So the original Leatherman's still alive, but the Leatherman, we all know, he's passed away. But other than that, all the village people are alive. And then they change it over, yes, and there's Ray Simpson, and he's still alive. So, which surprises me, because why are they not doing, like, I mean, come on, imagine a cruise ship with the village people. I mean, three members.
I mean, people wouldn't even realize they were the original village people. It would seem like it's a tribute band, right? Because it's so ridiculous.
Yeah, how would you know?
It's just ridiculous. And also, like, it's so un-PC now. You actually can't do it.
Yeah, you're right. The guy who played the Native American, now, I mean, so...
He was Latino.
Yes. Okay. Yes. However, I mean, this is why I say you do not enter a village people... rabbit hole, said no one in the 1870s ever, right? He won a NAMI, which is a Native American Music Award, for Best Historical Recording. Oh, he has a company called Tomahawk Group, but he's not Indigenous American. I think that's what you call it now, an Indigenous American. It is so bizarre. He won a NAMI. He's not even Native American. The village people never stop giving. They just never, ever stop giving. I love it.
Mm-mm.
I love it. I didn't update you. You told me to listen to a podcast about Milli Vanilli. Of course, we spoke about the Milli Vanilli biopic coming out and the story about them.
Yes.
And I listened to that podcast. What's it called?
Swindled.
That's what I was calling it. Scandal. Swindled. Really, firstly, really good podcast. Just done. The guy hosting it is the driest bastard I've ever heard in my life.
Deadpan, monotonous voice, but brilliant.
And so funny. Yeah.
He's so funny, and he delivers his funny, because he's actually just, I think it's also just brilliant writing.
Mm.
You know, he clearly scripts it, and it's brilliant. And it's just, but it's just delivered totally deadpan, even when he says the funniest things. It's a great show.
I mean, he does one part of, like, talking about selling out and really, like, compromising your artistic integrity to make a few dollars. Now let me do a live read for you. But, like, deadpan. Absolute deadpan.
But did you listen to the second story on that episode? Yes. After the Milli Vanilli?
Oh, my word. So yes, they tell the story of Milli Vanilli. Of course, how, you know, we all know the story, but it's actually a story about how these two young guys just really wanted to be famous so badly. They just went along. I mean, they were so young. I mean, they were like idiot kids.
They were completely exploited.
Totally.
Yeah,
right?
It was just very sad.
And everybody behind them, all the record execs, everyone behind them gets away scot-free, carries on as normal, no repercussions. Fab and Rob they ruined, and they had nothing. They just went along for the ride. But then the second story is about, I mean, Dory, it's so wild. You describe it. It's such a weird story compared to Milli Vanilli.
So they say it's like,
compared to Milli Vanilli.
So Milli Vanilli was like something that was pretending to be something that it wasn't. It's very complicated. And then this story was kind of the opposite of that, where it didn't exist in the first place. And this guy basically created this hype around himself that he was this incredible singer in this band, and he like manipulated YouTube to make it look like he had all this huge audience. Meanwhile, it was literally just him.
Yeah,
it was him. He created the whole thing himself. And then he managed to convince a bunch of musos to go on a tour with him, a tour that really was not, it didn't exist. It wasn't a thing. He said that he had like sold out tickets at the venues. The venues were like, who are you? What's going on? What a scam. It was something else. But I mean, he was just deluded is not even the word. And the best part was like when they talk about, because his brother was an actual kind of successful musician.
Yeah.
And he was just like, oh, he just wanted to be like me, but wow, like he just really went too far, you know, kind of thing. The thing is, his brother was like, no, join my band, like be with me. And he was like, no, I want to be my own thing. And then he just concocted this crazy fantasy persona. What a crazy story. But I felt so sorry for those guys who literally gave up their lives to go on tour with him. They thought that they were like about to hit the big time.
Yeah. But and the wildest thing about all of it is that he was actually a super talented musician. Like compared to Milli Vanilli, who had no musical talent, he was like a super talent. Like he was so like multiple instruments, songwriter, everything. But he just belonged to a band that didn't exist, going on tours that didn't exist.
That was where the opposite thing was that he actually had the talent, but he didn't have the following. Whereas Milli Vanilli, in inverted commas, didn't have the talent, but had the following. So I'll put the link up to it on our page as well, because it's really worth listening. I mean, like I say, the whole series is great, but that episode is particularly blew my mind, because I'd never heard of this guy, so I missed that whole story somehow. But because he didn't actually make as much of a splash as he had told everyone, but I can't believe the whole swindle story didn't like make more of a splash. But yeah, crazy.
No, exactly. And speaking about swindling people, on that 80 show, we're going to get into our movie recommendations. Every week we pick out a movie. Dori was worried. She said, oh, I don't know if I'm going to have a movie this week. Will it happen? She said this morning, I got a movie. Let's go. And I'm like, right. Lock it in.
So this week's movie was kind of inspired by something you said in last week's show. Do you remember how you were saying the great thing about the 80s was they really knew when to end stuff? They knew when to end a TV series. And it was that whole thing about how, you know, when you get older and you grow up and you get married and you have kids, it's not interesting anymore. So, like, don't show it to the masses. And in a way, that's kind of what my movie is about.
All right.
So this movie, before I tell you what it is, I'm going to actually just quickly read from the Wikipedia page, which says, this is actually, okay, so it's a John Hughes movie, which is a clue.
Okay.
And you know how much I love John Hughes. But this is my least favorite John Hughes movie. It is, however, Kevin Smith's favorite John Hughes movie, and it inspired him to make Jersey Girl. Now, let me say right now, here and now, that Jersey Girl is horrendous, and I didn't get through it, and this movie is way better than Jersey Girl. But it's like, wow, really crazy that I can't believe that this is his favorite one, because it's okay. You know what? Compared to other movies, because it's John Hughes, it's actually great, and it has some really cool moments. But if you compare it to other John Hughes films, then you're going to be like, Now, I remember seeing this movie on the big screen. It came out in 1988, and I actually do remember seeing it at movies, and I probably enjoyed it.
Okay.
But it certainly didn't stick in my mind as one of my favorite movies from my formative years. Unlike The Breakfast Club, Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink, etc., etc.
Sure.
So this is exactly that whole thing where the childhood sweethearts have grown up and now they're getting married, and the title is She's Having a Baby, which kind of gives away exactly the plot of the movie.
Why is that so familiar?
Kevin Bacon is the lead.
Is it a sequel to something?
It's not a sequel to something. It's not. However, Kevin Bacon is the lead, and then Elizabeth McGovern plays his wife, and they are like childhood sweethearts who get married very young. Now, one of the coolest things about this movie is that his best friend is played by Alec Baldwin, and this is Alec Baldwin in his hot youth, before he got all sweaty and horrible, and he's actually very good. He's very good in this role. I mean, we've discussed this when he's like his early roles. He was really good.
Yeah.
And his character is really cool because he's like the more successful. He's a rich best friend who's all single and, you know, sleeping with all the hot women and having the life. And then here's his friend who's about to settle down in the suburbs. And of course, Kevin Bacon has like this crisis of, oh my God, can I do this? I'm giving up my life. And
I mean,
there's a really great scene.
It reminds me of the song. I don't know if you've heard of this band called Wham. They've got a song called Young Guns, Having Some Fun, Crazy Days, Keep Him on the Run, Wise Guys Realize His Danger and Emotions High, See Me, Single and Free. It's like very much like that. Yes. And then also Wham Rap, If You're Happy with a Nappy, Then You're In for Fun, like, you know, Sleepless Nights on an HP Bed. It kind of like just leads perfectly into it. And yes, I am showing off how many Wham lyrics I know. But anyway, that's besides the point.
But it is exactly that thing. And it's almost, in a way, and that's probably why I don't like this film so much, it's almost cliched, which is very not John Hughes. John Hughes, like, his stuff is not cliched. But in this case, it really is. Where it's like, oh, of course the guy's going to be like, oh, I'm going to be stuck with the same woman for the rest of my life. Oh, my God, what am I doing? And it's like, oh, boring. But there's a great scene where he's literally outside it's his wedding day. He's in the suit, he's everything, and Alec Baldwin, his best friend and best man for the wedding, they're sitting in the car outside the church, and he's about to, like, he's like kind of got the whole cold feet thing, and he's like, oh, am I going to be happy? And Alec Baldwin says, you will be happy, you just won't know it. And that is one of those little John Hughes gems where it's like, it's like, it's supposed to be a comedy, but really there's a lot of deep stuff. And there is, and I mean, it's one of those movies where it's like very drama, very comedy, kind of interwoven. There's his boss, because he actually gets a job. So he wants to be a writer. He's one of these guys who, I mean, it's actually all in the trailer, so maybe we should, we'll put the trailer on our Facebook page. But I want you to play one part of the trailer, which is really also typically John Hughes and kind of funny, because the other thing that this movie has is a couple of little almost surreal moments where you're like, oh, that's just his imagination gone a bit weird kind of thing. So in the very beginning of the trailer, he's actually like literally standing there, you know, getting married. And there's this little scene that's really funny. So play the trailer, the link that I get sent you. And yeah, it's about the first 40 seconds or so.
All right.
Kristen, wilt thou have this man to be thy husband?
I will.
Wilt thou, Jefferson, have this woman to be thy wedded wife? Wilt thou provide her with credit cards and a four-bedroom, two-and-one-half bath home? Wilt thou listen patiently to long stories about kids' colds, kitchen towel, clothes, shoes, make a pair of sore feet, and decorate her six-foot covers?
I will.
I pronounce that Kristen and Jefferson are husband and wife.
In every married life, there are certain...
I gotta love the inconsistent 80s sound there. Okay.
It was very inconsistent. There's three versions of this trailer on YouTube, and that one has the best sound of the three.
So what I see as well is next to it, there's she's having a baby, this woman's work, Kate Bush. Is Kate Bush on the soundtrack?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so that's what I was going to get to. There is a very like dramatic, angsty scene spoiler alert, she is pregnant, she's about to have the baby, and something is potentially going wrong.
Is she pregnant before they get married or subsequent?
No. They actually struggle to get pregnant.
Right.
After all this, she stops taking the pill.
Okay.
He's like, oh, no, I don't want a baby. I don't want a baby. And she's like, I really want a baby. And she stops taking the pill, but she doesn't get pregnant anyway. And then they have the whole fertility struggle. Now, apparently, this movie is actually based on John Hughes' personal experience of becoming a dad.
Okay.
So there's a lot of, like, you know, detail, and I guess, personal experience that's been put in it. And that's, I suppose, what makes it a sentimental film for him or for, you know, people who can relate.
Mm.
Anyway, so she eventually gets pregnant and she's now about to have the baby and there's a complication and they kind of, because remember, it's only at the beginning of when dads were kind of allowed in for the birth.
Sure,
because
right.
In the beginning, I mean, in the olden days, like the dad was not inside the theater. And the nurses like kick him out, and they go, no, you can't come in. And so he starts having this complete freak out, and he has this very dramatic montage memory of their whole relationship and thinking that now something's going to happen to her or something's going to happen to the baby. And Kate Bush, this woman's work, is playing while he has this whole thing, remembering their whole life together, and it's very dramatic.
Yeah, I'm glad we could say Kate Bush. It's good for the SEOs. Kate Bush, Kate Bush, Kate Bush.
Yeah, we can
put it in our show notes, and then people find our show. Yeah, Kate Bush, yeah. Kate Bush.
Yeah, so like, it's basically, if you've just discovered Kate Bush, and you might not know this particular song, it's a particularly good experience to watch this movie.
Let's be honest. let's be honest. Most people discovered Kate Bush 5 months ago. Let's be very honest. Yeah. We won't stop till Babushka is number one again, but right, a lot of people just discovered Kate Bush.
So, I mean, I found an article on Den of Geek, we love Den of Geek, which about this movie, which says it is John Hughes' most personal film, being loosely based on his own experiences of being a young husband and father. So you understand why this film exists and all that kind of stuff. The guy who plays his boss is also the guy who plays the principal in The Breakfast Club. You know how John Hughes always used a lot of the same actors in his movies?
Yeah.
So the guy who plays the principal, why was the principal doing detention on a Saturday? Why not a random teacher?
This is
a question that is just like suddenly bugging my brain.
I'm sure it had to. I'm sure it got explained. It had to have been explained.
Anyway, so the guy who plays the principal in The Breakfast Club is also his boss, and I mean it's the same sort of like dry character. You know, he's really good. There's a really cool scene. So it ends with everything's fine, the baby's fine, she's all fine. Spoiler alert. And the end credits, they haven't named the baby.
This is what I want to talk to you about. Okay.
Yes.
Because I've just looked on the Wikipedia and I was like, I hope Dory brings this up. Okay.
Oh, yes. This is probably the best part of the film.
Listen.
Is in the end credits.
This looks like the best part of any film, judged by these names here. Okay. Go for it.
It's really kind of funny. So what they do in the end credits, they grab a whole bunch of other famous actors and actresses. And I mean, a lot of them... Again, John Hughes people like Elias Koteas and John Candy.
I think let's do this, right? How about you say what they're doing, and then I'll go through the list of people after that.
Okay, so basically they're saying he obviously went to them and said, "We need a name for a boy. What would you recommend as names for a boy?" And these people just. Were trying to be funny or whatever, and they would just talk to the camera and say and suggest names. But a couple of them were actually taken from scenes from other movies.
They play their characters, right?
For example.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not all of them. Just a few of them. So Matthew Broderick from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, it's really funny because other people say Ferris and then they show that scene of Ferris like looking around the doorway.
Right.
Like what? kind of thing. Yeah, it's really cool. Do you want to go through some of the names?
Okay. So firstly, now all these people are uncredited in the movie, and I've got to seek out the scene. Kirstie Alley, Dan Aykroyd as his character from The Great Outdoors. Like you said, Matthew Broderick as Ferris Bueller. John Candy as his character from Great Outdoors. Belinda frickin' Carlisle. Ted Danson. Yep. Woody Harrelson. Magic Johnson. Michael Keaton. You said Elias Koteas. Bill Murray.
Yeah.
The late Olivia Newton-John. Roy Orbison. Annie Potts, Ali Sheedy, and Bronson Pinchot, a.k.a. Balki Bartokomus.
John Ratzenberger.
John Ratzenberger, yes.
From Cheers,
yes.
Of course.
What?
Yes.
Marvel, let me talk to you guys about your end credit scenes, right? You do not have shit on end credit scenes until you have Magic Johnson in one of yours. What an unreal... Magic Johnson and Balki Bartokomus in the same piece of film together. What world are we living in? The John Hughes world. That's where we live.
And, of course, YouTube has provided. There is a clip of the end credit scene, which,
amazing.
Of course, will be up on our Facebook page.
That is outstanding.
Same thing.
Yes, that is outstanding.
It's a kind of a recommendation. Don't expect it to be as amazing as his other films, but it is better than most other films. Oh, there's this really crazy scene where so he's living the suburban life and he has to compete with the neighbors in terms of what lawnmower does he have. And then there's this whole weird surreal scene where everybody does this like musical style dance with their lawnmowers. It's really bizarre. It's also in the trailer.
It is Kevin Bacon.
So again, like I say, there's like these.
It is Kevin Bacon.
No,
you're gonna
make him dance.
You got Kevin Bacon. He's got to dance. I mean, let's be honest.
Yeah. So that's my movie. She's having a baby.
I don't know why I thought of this. Like, I know the name, but I actually didn't know the movie in detail. I don't know why I thought it was a sequel, the way you set it up, to She's Out of Control with Tony Danza, where his daughter becomes a teen. And I thought this was the follow-up to Now She's Having a Baby, like kind of like Father of the Bride. Like I kind of thought it was like a follow-up to that, which would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And just, you know, I want to say Tony Danza. So that's fun for me. Great movie recommendation just for that end credit scene. That sounds like a phenomenal piece of cinema. I want to talk to you about cinema, phenomenal pieces of cinema. What if I had to tell you, right? I say Tom Cruise, name his 80s movies. Just a couple, just top of your head.
Okay, big.
Tom Cruise, not, you see, you did what I did.
Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise, sorry. 80s movies. Top Gun.
Right. Cocktail. Cool.
Is Cocktail an 80s
movie? Yeah, it is.
89. It's very late 80s, I think. Eh?
But we get it, right? Tom Cruise. If I had to say to you Ridley Scott, right, his movies from the 80s. Okay, Alien was 1979, but I mean one of your favorites, right? Ridley Scott movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Blade Runner.
Aliens, is the sequel. Okay. Ridley Scott also did...
Blade Runner.
Of course.
Blade Runner. Can you forget?
He did, I can't remember what it's called, but this wonderful vampire movie he did as well. I can't remember what it's called.
Okay, cool. Good movie. The name Mia Sarah, do you know who that is? You know who she is, but maybe you don't know the name. Mia Sarah.
Don't know the name.
Ferris Bueller's girlfriend in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, right?
Okay.
That's cool. Tim Curry, 80s movies. What are we talking about? Clue, It, and Rocky Horror Picture Show, was late 70s.
Not 80s.
Huge in the 80s, though. Still huge. Rough.
Yes.
What if I told you?
Still huge now.
What if I told you all four of those people were in a movie together that you've probably never heard of?
I would believe you because I can't think of one.
Okay. So there was a genre of movie in the 80s called swords and sorcery movies, right? The Neverending Story, Conan the Barbarian, Willow, Labyrinth, Return to Oz. It's kind of like Clash of the Titans, kind of these mythical, sorcery types of films. They kind of worked in the 80s. They disappeared in the 90s when we were super cynical and kind of started reappearing again after the success of Lord of the Rings. And, of course, we have Game of Thrones and House of Dragons and all that shit. So it's quite big now. But in the 80s, it kind of was a thing for a while, right? When I was reading, why was it a thing? It's because kids wanted to escape the reality of potential nuclear war out of Russia, which is like, okay, so we're probably going to see a rise in fantasy movies again. Okay, so...
Right.
Comes out a movie. Tom Cruise had just done Risky Business. Stars in this movie called Legend. Have you ever heard of it?
I have heard of that. Yes.
Yes, good.
I think I might have even seen it.
Okay.
But I definitely don't remember it.
Right, no. I'm going to show you something because everyone goes, oh, I don't know that movie. So Tom Cruise, he's a human. I think he is a human, okay? I don't think he's a mythical creature. But he's a human, lives by himself, and he's surrounded by, he's a hermit, right? Which I thought, is that a mythical creature? No, it's just a lonely person. And he's surrounded by...
Not a hobbit.
No, a hermit, right. Although, we know he has to stand on a box and have lifts in his shoes and all the shit, so be that what it may. And he has Tom Cruise in all his monotooth glory, right? The monotooth is there. It's strong. And he lives amongst all these mythical creatures, elves, pixies, gnomes, trolls, ghouls. And he lives in this magical land. And everything's lovely. And he meets this Mia Sarah's character, who is a princess, right? And Tom Cruise goes, I need to show you these unicorns, right? They're the most mythical. And he takes her to go see these unicorns. Now, in the background, Tim Curry plays Darkness. But for all intents and purposes, he's Satan. In probably one of the best portrayals of Satan, other than Billy Zane, okay, when he played Satan. So Darkness now needs the princess to touch one of these unicorns, which is not allowed, so that he can now spread darkness and take over the world, and there will be no more light, and he will rule, and he can rule again, because he's been confined to the darkness. So this happens now, and she now becomes kind of like a whole Adam and Eve thing. She follows temptation, touches a unicorn, and now... As we know, guys who are like super into devils in the 80s, a girl like kind of likes him, and suddenly she goes from this beautiful princess, super goth. Next thing, she's goth, whole chest exposed, wearing head like whole head gears and everything, and she becomes evil, which is quite cool because princesses never become bad, where she becomes quite bad, and you actually like don't like her for a long time in this movie. And the whole movie's around getting her back to the light. And she gets back to the light, we can kill the demon. Now you go, oh, have I seen this movie?
Sounds a little bit Maleficent-y. Oh,
it's all of them. It's all of them. It's not, yeah, like, you know, yeah, it's all of them, right? I've put a link there for you. Now, this is what Tim Curry looks like in this movie. You won't know it's Tim Curry because he's wearing so much makeup. But you have definitely seen this character before. Tim Curry's darkness, a.k.a. Satan. Have you popped it up there? This is what he looks like in this movie. Absolutely terrifying.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. This is on our 80 Show Facebook.
You know what he looks like?
Facebook.
He looks like a real version of Satan from South Park.
Right. That's exactly what I thought. Down to the cloven hooves. So much so that I went to do a little bit of research to say, were they inspired by it? I have no doubt they were. Because that's exactly what he looks like, Satan from South Park. But this character has now kind of had a revival, like in the late 2000s and onwards, because this movie flopped in the 80s. Didn't really work out. There were a few reasons for it. Runtime was too long, blah, blah. People just didn't get it. Maybe there was fatigue over this type of movie.
This, but it was so forgettable. So forgettable.
It became a cult thing, because I've got to tell you, now, like, I watched the remastered version, right? So everything's been kind of cleaned up. The practical effect to make these two lands of the light and the dark, you know, now, like, everything's CGI'd, everything's on a blue screen, or they're in the volume, you know, the volume that the Disney used to make all the Star Wars movies. Like, this is all practical. All the sets actually really exist. They kind of did this weird thing of whenever they're in the light, it's, like, mythical, and these little spectacles in the air. They had, like, chicken feathers being blown around to give it that effect. So everything's super practical. All the costumes are practical. There's no CGI. Everything is all practical effects, which is like you watch, you go, wow, that is really cool compared to today. I mean, the stuff looks great today, but there's a craft to it, right? So Tim Curry's Satan or darkness in this, people have kind of gone, wow, that is an awesome interpretation of like this creature. He's got the cloven hooves. His horns are massive, 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 massive. They weighed like a couple of kilos, like super heavy. And Tim Curry and this costume is just menacing. The whole time. Tim Curry is menacing as shit. Like, he's the bro. When he opens his mouth up like that, he's probably the scariest person. And he does that. How they get him to do that in this movie with these prosthetic teeth and then his real weird Tim Curry face still comes through. So there's an interesting quirk about this movie. It was released with two soundtracks. So the one soundtrack gets released, like, all very, like, you'd expect a movie like this to have, right? So all very orchestral, Celtic influences, you know, that type of thing. You'd expect that. And that got released in the UK version, right? And when Ridley Scott remastered it, he put that original soundtrack back in. For whatever reason, in the US, it had a different soundtrack done by, do you remember Tangerine Dream?
Yes, of course. They did the music for Risky Business.
Right.
Well, at least they did a couple of tracks on Risky Business.
But they're very synth, poppy, electro. And there was the American release had the Tangerine Dream soundtrack on it, which is weird because it's not that, like, it's not that world. Fit. No. To the point that even Brian Ferry, because they're trying to do a Lamalia, they're trying to do a Never Ending Story, Brian Ferry did a title song to it. Called Is Your Love Strong Enough, written by David Gilmour of Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd.
Yeah. Right, so that was on the American one.
Complicated. Very complicated.
Yes, yes. So those were the two. The American version flopped when Ridley Scott got to do the version he wanted at the length he wanted. He put in the soundtrack he wanted. That's the version you'll find. I mean, I saw it. I watched it on Apple TV. It is you can rent it. And then I also saw on Google Play Store, their online hiring service. It is on there. And both the extended American UK versions on there. It's a really good film. They actually say, you know the video game Legend of Zelda? The Nintendo game.
Okay.
If you've seen it, you know it. It's like if you see it, you know it. They say that the story of that is so similar that they were inspired by this film to make Legend of Zelda and kind of create a similar world and a similar realm with princesses and the darkness, blah, 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 and the balance. And that's what the whole movie is about. It's just about balance, light, dark, good. It's like very obvious, but it's very well done. Yeah. And this is the thing, right? Here's another thing about these fantasy movies, why the good ones worked and the shit ones didn't. The good ones worked because, like, say, the never-ending story is there's just something magical about all those creatures and characters and, you know, the luck dragon. There's just something that sticks in your head about it. And then things like Conan the Barbarian was a really good lore. And Willow was, I mean, you know, George Lucas wanted to do The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, but he couldn't get the rights, so he just made his own world. And then Labyrinth was David Bowie. So, I mean, what with David Bowie is going to suck, you know? And that's why those kind of worked. And it's weird that this movie never became bigger because that's a stellar cast. I mean, there's no chances in anybody. Ridley Scott's phenomenal. Sir Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, like how, and Mia Sara's like solid. She's 15 in this movie. Kissing a 23-year-old Tom Cruise, that's kind of like...
Wow.
It's kind of like John Hughes. Yes, because
it would have been before Ferris Bueller,
right? It was.
Right.
So,
okay.
There's no chances in this movie. Everything's beautifully done. Everything's great. So, it's weird that it just didn't fire. It just, like, kind of went there. Maybe to the point that Tom Cruise has never spoken about it. He didn't like it. He just, like, didn't like the cut that came out. And, you know, he deemed, you know... The Royal Cruise said, "I'm not into it. It's done. I'm not going to do this." So anyway, that is my movie legend.
His hair is quite long in it, right? I mean, I'm just looking at the pictures on IMDb. Yeah, his hair is long.
Yeah, he's got like a weird little ponytail. He wears a little like a little skirt all around, romping the forest.
Maybe that's why he didn't like it. He was like, maybe that's just not me. I am a tough fighter pilot.
And this is just before Top Gun. And listen, you can definitely see that he's short in this movie. So that, you know, maybe he wasn't big star power to like hide his height.
He doesn't like it.
Yeah. No, he definitely comes, you go, okay, this is not a tall guy. But the thing is, Dory, right? Here's the thing. Fantasy movies, yeah. I keep going. I've done Red Sonja, I've done Conan, I've done Legend, I've done Willow, and yet I will not watch The Princess Bride.
Isn't it amazing? Amazing.
It's a bit of a thing now.
So now it's a thing. So now you're going to make it a thing.
Yep.
But you're missing out. You're the one missing out. It's really funny because I'm on this Gen X Facebook group, which I really enjoy, actually, and they post some cool shit. And one of the things that was posted in the last couple of days, somebody said, "What movies did you love as a kid that you still love now? Because my kids are kind of getting to that age, and I want to show them, like, you know, movies that have stood the test of time, basically, from the 80s. And you would not believe how many people posted The Princess Bride.
Pardon. Really?
So many. Yeah. Back to the Future was also very popular. I suggested Princess Bride, Back to the Future, Beetlejuice. There was one other. Oh, what was the other one? Who knows? But a lot of people suggested Goonies.
Yeah.
But Princess Bride came up a lot. Mm. You will never know.
Okay. Well, but like I say, it's a thing now. I can't watch it now. You know, so I saw a meme. You mentioned Beetlejuice. Did this happen in Beetlejuice? Yeah. It's like, I attended Juilliard. I'm a graduate of Harvard Business School. I travel extensively. I lived through the Black Plague. I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it. Is that really a quote from Beetlejuice? I don't remember that. I don't know if it's
doesn't sound familiar.
No. It's kind of like they're trying to retcon Beetlejuice. Listen, Dory, we're going to go into something we haven't done in a very long time. All the details of our movies are on That 80 Show SA Facebook page. We're going to Wham Corner purely because you've got a Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go pun that you need to explain to me because I just don't get it. Do you have it on hand?
Well, who says I can explain it to you?
Okay, well, let's...
So anyway, we'll get into it.
We'll get into it. Welcome back to That 80 Show. Now, strap in... I love a pun. I do love a pun. But there is one shared around in our little world that I cannot understand. And Dory's going to explain it to me.
Or not explain it to you, as the case will turn out to be.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know if you know who Amanda Palmer is.
I was going to say Robert Palmer's wife. I wasn't quick enough. All right. No, I don't know.
Okay, we don't have time for me to explain who Amanda Palmer is, but let's just say
she's a singer.
she's a singer, she's a writer, she does a, quite a bit of things. She's also in a relationship with Neil Gaiman.
Okay.
They have a child together. Right. They're not married, which is why I say in a relationship with. She's, I guess, kind of weird and wacky, and she does quite a bit of activism and stuff like that. Anyway, I really like her. She came to South Africa a few years ago, met her. She was really cool. She has a band called the Dresden Dolls, which don't love them, don't hate them. Some songs are better than others. People, they're very cult following. Mm-hmm. People go a bit crazy for her. She also did a really amazing TED talk called The Art of Asking. That is what you want to see.
Right.
But I do follow her on social media. I love the stuff she posts generally. I do enjoy the stuff she writes. The other day she posted something, last week she posted something on Facebook that of course got my attention. You're about to find out why. And it confused the hell out of me.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to tell you, we're going to try and figure it out, and maybe our listeners can help us figure it out, because this is what she posted. I was exactly today years old when I realized, despite being a wordplay-savvy songwriter of considerable repute who owned Wham's Make It Big on vinyl at age 10, in addition to probably having heard the song 1,000 plus times in my lifetime, that Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go is a goddamn pun.
Now, I am a 42-year-old man, and I own Make It Big on vinyl, and I have listened to it over 5,000 times, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. Okay, so right. Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go is a pun. Right.
Okay, so I go to the comments to see how people are reacting to this post, because I was a bit confused, I'll be honest. Everyone in the comments was as confused, because everybody had a different interpretation of what she was saying.
Okay.
Now, I mean, I've never really thought deeply what is Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go about? We know where the song title came from. Andrew Ridgeley was a little bit drunk one night. He left a note for his mom on the fridge that he had scrawled when he came home drunk after a night out. And it actually said something like, wake me up before you go-go, or something, wake me up before you go-go, whatever. Anyway, the point is it inspired them to name the song, but I never really
that's like
interrogated
when,
the lyrics.
That's like when,
yes.
Has drunk you ever left a message for sober you for the next morning?
No, yeah. I don't drink that much, so no.
You don't. Drunk me has left messages for sober me for the next morning. It's like put stuff on my phone. Yeah, he's put stuff on my phone, like... Yeah, remember your hat is in the chimney, like he fucks with me. So that's what drunk
it's like talking to a time traveler. That's hilarious.
Exactly. So be careful of the notes drunk you leaves. It could mean nothing, it could inspire a hit song. You know, it could be anything.
Right. Right. So now a lot of, I don't know. I mean, have you ever given thought as to what the song is about, what it means? I mean, I suppose if I had given it a little bit of thought, it's about, you know, he's with this girl that he really likes, and he wants, he's like, don't leave, like, you know, wake me up before you leave. I don't know.
Just, I have listened.
Like, I don't know. They haven't thought about it that much.
I have consumed enough Wham media through books, interviews, whatever, to fully understand that Wham is not, there's no like science or greater meaning behind them. It's like Club Tropicana, where drinks are free and you can suntan. It's like there's no meaning behind there. So I go to this place, all included, meals, drinks, Tony Pike, I can suntan. You know, there's no hidden message. There's nothing hidden in early Wham. Maybe from Careless Whisper, when George Martin, okay, maybe that starts. Maybe there is deep meaning in Last Christmas, which is heartbreaking, right? But when we're talking the Wham staples, we're not talking, there's not high literature yet. I love them. It's bubblegum.
Right?
It's bubblegum. Like, I thought, like, when you said it out loud, I thought it was like, but hold on, maybe one of them dated the Go-Go's. But no, they, you know, Andrew Ridgeley.
No, okay, so let me tell you some of the thoughts that were in the comments from her fans. So people were like, oh, they're talking about the Go-Go dance. I'm like,
No.
The most popular theory in the comments was that Go-Go is code for having sex, masturbating, etc. Something to that effect, where it's like, wake me up before you go.
I thought, like, when you bought, like, I don't know who Amanda Palmer was, right? So right, I thought maybe she's South African, and I thought, so in South African, a granny is a gogo. So I thought, like, maybe wake me up before your gogo. Like, I thought maybe that's what I'm missing. Like,
I am so confused by this post, and, like, people were asking her, like, you know, saying, like, help us. And she often does reply to comments, but look, I haven't checked it in the last few days. At the point that I last checked this thread, there was no answer to this.
What's the name?
I will investigate it further.
Do it. What's the name of her TED talk? What's the name of
her
TED talk?
Her TED talk is called The Art of Asking.
You see, there you go. It's all promotion for the TED talk because she wants you to ask, and she's like, oh, well, listen, The Art of Asking, if you want to find out, you know, register for my TED talk. She's a performance artist. We've been duped. We've been duped by Amanda Palmer, and now we're addicted to a love of Wham. And that's, you know, it's just serendipitous.
Well, I think we should ask your cousin Louis, who is probably the as big a Wham fan as us, if he has thoughts on this.
We will ask him that. I will find out and I will feed
back. And then, yeah, maybe we can see if anyone on our Facebook page also has any thoughts. I'll share her post onto our Facebook page and let's see what everyone thinks.
I think it's performance art. I think it's performance art. I don't trust her.
Makes the most sense, actually.
Yes. So that Facebook page is That 80 Show SA. Thank you for everyone who's contributing and liking our stuff. You know, it's very satisfying when you post up something. My favorite post this week is somebody has deep faked Nicolas Cage's face onto Rick Astley and made Nick Astley singing I'm Never Gonna Give You Up.
Nick,
I mean,
that
is what deep fakes are all about. It's still somewhere on the stream. Just go back and look at it. Like, deep fakes, like, I know people are very concerned. Why? Are they stealing our identity? It doesn't matter. It's all for the best of making yet another Rick Astley video with Nicolas Cage. And can anything get better? Now, we've explored a lot this show, Dari. I mean, we've had, you know, an analysis of Wham lyrics. Like, who does that? We've deep dived into.
If anyone does it, it's us.
That's us.
Let's be honest.
Very niche. Yeah. They say, you know, podcasts are niche, and God damn it. I think even for me, the favorite thing I learned this week was Village People's new wave album. That is glorious.
Well, I mean, my favorite thing that I learned this week is that the Village People did whiteface and should be cancelled.
Ah, good point. Good point. Cancel Village People. You heard it, yeah, first. Thanks for joining me, Tori. Goodbye.
Bye.